we'll move into our first presentation from Lynn Broaddus. Lynn joined the Johnson Foundation at Wingspread in December of 2008, and she's responsible for shaping the foundation's environmental programming with an emphasis on the freshwater crisis facing the United States. Much of Lynn's work has focused on leading a diverse set of stakeholders to issue a call to action on U.S. freshwater challenges. Prior to joining the Johnson Foundation, Lynn served for 6 years as executive director of Milwaukee Riverkeeper. She also spent 12 years working for the Nature Conservancy and NatureServe, where her role as director of U.S. network partnerships focused on negotiating data sharing agreements among the nation's natural heritage programs. Lynn holds a bachelor's degree in environmental sciences from the University of Virginia and a master's in business administration from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She has a doctorate in botany and genetics from Duke University, and she serves on the boards of Riverkeeper Network and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So with that, Lynn, I will turn it over to you for your presentation. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Emma. The Johnson Foundation at Wingspread, which is where I work, we're here in Racine, Wisconsin, and we've focused much of our work over the last 4 or 5 years on U.S. freshwater sustainability issues. And if there's one thing we've learned from this, it's that water and climate change are inextricably linked. Some of the most concerning aspects and impacts of climate change are felt through water, and many parts of the country are already experiencing these through more intense rainfall events, record flooding. It can also bring with that increased erosion and pollution, more sewer overflows, changes in waterborne disease patterns, and this sort of thing. We're also experiencing increased periods of drought, even in parts of the country where total precipitation isn't changing. And on top of that, our electric grid is highly dependent on water, whether that's for cooling the thermoelectric power plants or driving hydropower plants. And peak electric use is likely to occur during heat waves, times when water resources are likely to be stretched at their limits. So it's entirely possible that the greatest need for electricity will happen when water is not available to run those power plants at their maximum, which can lead to quite a challenge. And that's the picture that's up here in the top of this PowerPoint, during a heat wave, not having the electricity to run the air conditioners to take care of those who are really vulnerable. So from a water perspective, adaptation largely means slowing down the water as it falls, doing a better job of storing it and cleaning it for future use, all at a time of in a manner that uses less fossil fuels. So in terms of what that means for adaptation in a water context, that we tend to think in terms of green infrastructure, and that includes everything from natural corridors and protecting the our natural infrastructure, creating wetlands or restoring wetlands to absorb rainwater. It also includes beefing up our built environment so that it can mimic and recreate some of the natural infrastructure that was there originally, whether that be through green roofs or permeable pavement. This picture you see in the bottom right of the screen is from Harley-Davidson here in Milwaukee. They have permeable pavement and grass pavers. Their museum is right along a river, and so they've done a lot to help with stormwater absorption. Much of this work is done for water quality purposes, not necessarily specifically being driven by concerns around adaptation, but concerns with water quality. It also includes adaptation, also includes finding ways to capture water for future use. That can be in rain barrels and cisterns, but it can also include expediting ways for rainwater to recharge subsurface aquifers. Groundwater recharge can help in the general sense, ensuring base flow for urban rivers and streams during times of drought. Also, through cooling the water before it enters the streams, that helps in terms of fisheries, habitats, and water quality, but also can be absolutely critical to being able to for thermoelectric power plants. In Los Angeles, we're seeing pioneering efforts to capture that stormwater in a large scale to be able to use as part of their water supply. And that's the picture you see in the center of the screen is an infiltration bed in Los Angeles where they're really trying to engineer and track the success of this and the ability to use their rainwater for eventual water supply. The Urban Ecology Center in the bottom left of the screen is one of a growing number of structures in the U.S. where they're going sort of partly off-grid with water, capturing rainwater to use for non-potable uses such as flushing toilets and outdoor water use. But the question on the table today is really around how do we pay for this work? In the case of water adaptation, most of the work to date has not been driven by concerns about a changing climate, but by concerns about compliance with the Clean Water Act. And here, the 6% of the people who responded to the poll that they haven't yet taken action because of the controversial nature of climate change. Doing water adaptation work is a great way to accomplish your adaptation needs and goals without having to raise any questions about climate change. There are legal requirements to do this work, either to reduce sewer overflows or to meet new stormwater regulations that are rolling out for municipalities. But the question is how to do it in a way that doesn't break the bank. Finding money to do this work is never easy, but it has become more and more evident that the least cost way to meet Clean Water Act goals is with the use of green infrastructure, both engineered and natural. But paying for it, figuring out and paying for it is certainly a balancing act. There are different phases of the work, planning it, executing it, and maintaining it. Many times these are not clear boundaries between these things. There's the issue of scale, whether it's at a very site-specific project, all the way up to state-level planning, and of course everything in between. As far as how to pay for it, one has to think both about the financing of it and then actually where the money is going to eventually come from in the long term. In terms of financing, sometimes there's cash reserves, especially on the part of a water utility or a city. Generally not enough to pay for any kind of large-scale project, but this can be enough for planning or for getting some of the initial work going. Other routes are either through loans or sometimes through grants, either federal grants or private grants. How to pay for it in the long run? Certainly there are tax levies, whether that be property tax, sales tax, TIF districts, ratepayer fees. They generally fall in one of three categories: water fees for drinking water, sewer fees, or stormwater fees, which more and more places have. And then, of course, there's what I call other people's money. That includes foundation money, but it also includes money from other agencies or other levels of government, or even match money in terms of volunteer labor. Now, depending on, I don't know if I'll be able to get through all of the examples in the presentation, but if you let me just put this resource out here as one-stop shopping. It's hot off the presses. I wasn't aware of it when we first started planning this webinar. But this report released last week by American Rivers and NRDC, and you can find it through either one of their web pages, is an unbelievably comprehensive resource to walk you through planning. But then it also has an appendix of funding resources. And it's, as you see from the title, it's a guide for state action, but it seems to me in my reading of it that it's very applicable even if you're working for a municipality or a watershed, no matter what your perspective. I think this would be a really important resource. But this long appendix has an incredible treasure trove of funding resources from federal and state governments, and they break it out by different whether you're in the planning phase or the implementation phase for these projects, and I highly, highly recommend that report. A typical way, though, to pay for some of this water infrastructure is with EPA state revolving fund loans, which are passed through to, in most cases, passed through to the states, and a water utility or a municipality can apply for these funds. In the originally, most water infrastructure was paid for with grants through the Federal Clean Water Act. But in the last decades, the grant sources have really been cut off, and for the most part, these are low-interest loans provided through the state that can be used for water infrastructure. But in the last 2 years or so, there's been, largely through the work of advocacy work of American Rivers and NRDC, there's been a set-aside for green infrastructure, which includes water efficiency and energy efficiency. So, and I think in a number of states, those green reserve has not been fully utilized. So that money is something to really look at for as a source for funding. You can certainly also look to foundations and private partners and NGO partners. It takes some time to develop a relationship to access these funds, but there have been some really remarkable examples of where foundations and NGO partners have played a really important role in the adaptation work. Recently, the Cleveland Foundation awarded $400,000 to Cleveland's sewage district to help with the region's sewer plan. The sewage district was allocating around $3 billion for their work, and the Cleveland Foundation has given significant funding there to create the green aspects of that plan. Foundations and NGO partners can also be really important in terms of convening and bringing people together to help get buy-in for the plan and help develop different aspects of the plan. The Nature Conservancy and NRDC have been doing some really monumental work in piloting novel ways to finance stormwater retrofits. They focused on Philadelphia, but the hope is that their concepts can go broader. And it's their idea, they've been working on ways to bring private dollars to do stormwater retrofit work on private property. Frequently, the public dollars are not available to do this work. And so I recommend that you take a look at that. In particular, in stormwater fees, in terms of being able to pay for this in the long run, municipalities who have looked at this in a way, not only how to pay for the stormwater, but how to drive incentives to treat stormwater on site so that those who are doing a good job with this pay less. Philadelphia has led the way in this work. They have gone from stormwater fees that were tied to how much water you use. So in other words, a hospital would pay a lot, and a used car lot with a huge impervious surface would pay very little. They've switched it so that the fee structure is based on your impervious surface. And other cities have looked at these kind of models and found that they are a much fairer way to pay for stormwater in the long run and drive the kind of behavior that they want. You can go to this URL and learn more about how Philadelphia has done this. I know Lancaster, Pennsylvania is another place that's done some really thoughtful work in this area. Certainly partnering with other agencies, for instance, transportation agencies, transportation services take up as much as 25 to well more than that percent of the impervious area in a municipality or in a suburban area. And so being able to partner with transportation agencies to access some of their funds to pay for this work can be really important. In fact, I've heard statistics from more than one municipality that if they do their retrofit work in conjunction with the Department of Transportation's work, it costs them one-tenth what it would cost normally. And it's not because they're using transportation money, it's because they're doing it in conjunction with when streets are being ripped up. But there are a number of other agencies that are involved in impervious surface management, basically. And so whether it's HUD or Parks and Rec or working with schools, these are all places that by working jointly, one can stretch the dollars and do things synergistically. I put a link here to New York City's plan. I think that's one of the best examples of a municipality that has worked, you know, brought all these different agencies together in thinking through how to do this collectively. An unusual example is a TIF district that was put in place about 10 years ago in Milwaukee. They have a large industrial valley that was being renovated. It takes up about 2 or 4 square miles in the city of Milwaukee. And rather than asking each parcel to manage stormwater, and rather than hooking this valley up to the deep tunnel, they created a tax incremental financing district for a shared stormwater park that these photos don't do justice to how beautiful it is down there. And that way the property owners don't have to work on it individually. Now, this is stormwater, but it's also climate adaptation work. So I leave you with a couple of other resources that you can turn to for how to pay for this work and things to think about as you're developing your plans. One of them is a report that we did here at the Johnson Foundation and is really around what kinds of things do you want to make sure are incorporated in the financing of water infrastructure to ensure sustainability. The second bullet there, Ceres, a nonprofit based in Boston, has done an increasing amount of work around how to ensure that there's transparency around the fee structures and financing and debt financing for water and sewer. And this is especially important relative to the changes coming with climate change. And this can, by using this framework, I think it can help build citizen input for adaptation work and making sure that the utility is taking these kind of concerns into concern. This third recommended report here is a treasure trove of cost comparisons for what green infrastructure would cost versus what the gray alternative would cost. And I think there have been a lot of concerns that green infrastructure, where am I going to get the money? But if you're being forced to do because of the Clean Water Act, to do these stormwater and water system retrofits, it pencils out that in the long run, if you look at a life cycle analysis, the green infrastructure is hands down, in almost every case, the least cost alternative, and that's without including carbon market concerns. And then a link to this NRDC report about how to create private markets to bring private dollars into paying for green stormwater infrastructure. And I think I'll leave it at that and then be available for questions afterwards.
Thank you, Lynn. Hopefully that presentation gives folks some ideas of where they may form potential partnerships and some opportunities, particularly in the water sector. If anyone has any questions for Lynn, please take a moment to type those in your GoToMeeting panel. And I'll just take a second to point out that EPA's Climate Ready Water Utilities program has a lot of great resources available to help drinking water and wastewater facilities adapt to a changing climate, and they do have a great webcast series about all of their tools and resources, and I believe a few of those webcasts are coming up in the near future. So I included a link to their program in my slides, so you can certainly get to that material, and I encourage folks to do so. So before we turn to the demo from Scott Burgess, we're going to pull up another poll question. So folks could take a minute to provide their responses. The question is, what are the primary sources of funding that you have used for adaptation? All right, Lauren, if we could pull up the responses. All right, so it looks like about 37% have responded that they've not done any adaptation work yet. About 30% are focusing on state or local funds. 26% have used federal funds, and about 11% each have used funding from NGOs or foundations or have realigned their internal budgets. And certainly there are a lot of opportunities within all of these categories and strategies to kind of cobble together funding from different sources, and our presentations today should hopefully give folks a sense of where they can look for some of these opportunities.